La Jolla, California, UC San Diego Athletics presents TritonCast, the podcast for the UC San Diego Tritons. Here are your hosts, Jeff Toriel and Jenny Stevens.
Welcome to episode 18 of TritonCast, the official podcast for UC San Diego Athletics. Alongside Jeff Toriel, I'm Jenny Stevens. Whether you found us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, UCSDTritons.com, or anywhere else, we're so happy that you've joined us today. And if you like what you hear, make sure that you subscribe, rate, and give us a brief review. It would mean a lot to us. Jeff, what's coming up on today's show?
Well, Jenny, coming up in today's Triton Spotlight, we'll have a conversation with former UC San Diego thrower Vince Tejasaputra. The 2009 grad shares with us about his educational and professional journey following his time at UC San Diego, including a stint in Canada. Now, Vince works at the National Science Foundation near Washington, D.C., and that's where he helps scientists communicate in effective ways. Our conversation with Vince Tejasaputra will come your way shortly in this week's Triton Spotlight.
But first, we go around campus. We hope that you all enjoyed the virtual homecoming festivities over the weekend. It was so great getting to see everybody's social media posts from all the different events. This week on social media, we're joining NCAA schools from across the country to celebrate diversity and inclusion. Check out at UCSD Tritons on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to watch a powerful video of why Triton scholar athletes believe their stories matter.
You won't want to miss that. For now, it's on to this week's Triton Spotlight. Here's our conversation with UC San Diego track and field alum, Vince Tejasaputra.
So tell us, Vince, when did you first develop an interest in track and field?
I was actually a track and field athlete in high school. It was a way for the football players to stay in shape in the off season. And it turns out that, you know, if you're 5'8", you don't go that far in high school football, getting recruited to college. I mean, there's a couple of NFL superstars that are 5'8" or shorter, but I am not one of them. So, you know, started off doing actually the 100-meter sprint. And it turns out that you just take the strongest and biggest 100-meter sprinters and you turn them into throwers. And so I ended up getting an interest, you know, in track and field that way. So that sort of started off my path into collegiate athletics.
So did you always expect then that you would compete in track and field at the collegiate level?
Not really, actually. I was looking to get recruited for football. I realized I had a little bit more success as a track and field athlete, as a thrower specifically. It's funny, I reached out to the coaches at UCSD, and you know, after I got in, after I got onto the team, they said, we put your name in the cold file. So I ended up getting into UCSD academically, and I ended up walking on. So that was a really great opportunity for me.
So what was that walk-on experience like then for you being on the team?
It was really intimidating. Division II school, pretty well-known in California and on the West Coast. By far, again, like I was the shortest one. And so I always had some sort of something to prove. And even though I wasn't the best technically, I knew that I had the drive to, you know, be the first in the weight room and be just working really hard. So it sort of turned the tryouts into a competition, right? So, you know, they would give you certain marks for specific events like the overhead throw or the long jump or the sprint and stuff like that. So I prepared, I knew what those events were and I prepared for them in the weeks coming into UCSD. So I was pleasantly surprised that I made the team as a walk-on.
So for our listeners who maybe aren't quite as familiar with throwing, talk a little bit about what that entails and how you prepare for that.
So throwing, it's the and field part of track and field. And so in collegiate and Olympic athletics, throwing encompasses, I would say javelin throw, the discus throw, hammer throw, and shot put. And so we're obviously a little bit different than, we don't run laps. We don't run in the woods. We get up, we throw, we lift, we eat, we sleep, and we repeat. So we're a little bit different than the rest of the track team, but you know, it sort of results in a closer knit group. So the training is pretty rigorous because all we do is lift. And so the point is to become strong enough and put enough mass on that you can transfer that that power into the implement. And it's also, like, at least particularly for the hammer throw and the disc and the shot, but actually for all the throwing events, it's the smallest practice to performance ratio, right? Like, we spend maybe 4.5 seconds in the ring, maybe 10 seconds in the ring. And you know, we train for a lot longer. Maybe 100 meter sprinters are as close to that as possible. But yeah, throwing is a little bit special. We're all a little bit weird. That's our breed.
That's a really interesting perspective on it. I love that. When you look back on your throwing career at UC San Diego, what were some of the highlights for you?
Mostly the camaraderie. You know, as I said, to your last question, like, we're sort of outsiders, and we developed the relationship with the distance runners, because the distance runners are kind of outsiders too. Like, you know, the 5K runners, the 10K runners, they don't train on the track really. They, you know, they are mostly coming over from cross country. So we developed a kinship, and they would do their night before the races carbo loading, and so would the throwers, even though we don't need it. We just eat a lot. So, you know, we developed, you know, unlikely friendships. And so a lot of those relationships, they've stuck around till now. So that's really, you know, I was a mediocre to a bad athlete at UCSD. And that's not, like, my athletic performance is not really what defined my time there.
Yeah, I know, obviously, academics is a huge part of the UC San Diego experience as well. Talk a little bit about why you decided to be a human biology major when you were at UC San Diego.
So, like, everybody who goes to UCSD, or at least half of the people who go to UCSD, want to go to medical school, right? And so I thought human biology might be the closest thing to help me get into med school. And it's really not until, like, maybe Chem 6B or probably organic chemistry that after half of the people fail out that you start to look at other avenues for your life. I always liked biology. I always loved the life sciences. To me, that was always the most hands-on thing in the lab. That was an extension of having really great high school biology teacher. And so I knew I wanted to be somewhat in the life sciences.
Well, like you mentioned, that's obviously a very challenging major. How was it for you balancing that major with athletics?
I was never on the dean's list. I will just say that. I think that, you know, non-athletes kind of smirk at athletes having the benefit of having priority registration. But that's not as great as you think, because we have to register classes at 8 a.m. so we can make, you know, practices. And so it is difficult, and especially UCSD is a place where, you know, you're certainly embodies the student athlete. Back when I was going through, I think that, you know, the average GPA of the student athlete is higher than the general population, general student body. So it takes a special person to balance those things, and taking a midterm on the road and writing a paper on the bus, you know, coming back at midnight from you know, whatever competition, you know that you got to get ready in the morning, because if, you know, if you don't pass, you don't play. So that was a thing that was a real challenge for me. But, you know, we all stepped up. So.
Yeah, absolutely. What advice would you give to our current scholar athletes about managing that workload?
I would say seek help, and not in a sarcastic way, but I think if you take the time to get to know your professors, and again, having been in academia for a long time, especially at UCSD, where the classes can be 300 people, that might be a challenge. But also, you know, connecting with TAs, the teaching assistants and graduate students. Nothing really replaces the one-on-one mentorship that you can get from, you know, especially if you're trying to balance your time and And speaking as somebody who taught for many years, if I recognize a name that you know, came to me with questions or sent me emails and had a genuine interest in improving themselves, you know, if they're right on the edge, then that sometimes helps make the decision, you know, whether to bump you up a grade or not. Obviously, that's not an official thing, but certainly it helps to have your name known, especially if you're curious about whatever you're studying.
Definitely good advice for the scholar athletes. I know you mentioned earlier that a lot of UC San Diego students obviously have med school in their sights. What was next for you after graduating from UC San Diego?
So I ended up being an exercise physiologist, and it's actually funny because it really ties in my time as an athlete. You know, being a thrower, you want to be big, you want to be strong. And so we're looking for every sort of advantage that we can get. And now it's been 16 years since I've been a student athlete. So some of my teammates were looking into taking this supplement that was a little bit questionable, not in an illegal sense, but, you know, it was this protein powder that said, this will change your DNA to grow bigger muscles. Hmm. And I was like a second or third year bio student. Even I know that it was either BS or it was illegal or both. And so I emailed the professor in the Department of Medicine and said, hey, I know that you have some exercise science background. I'm on the track team. What do you know about this, if anything? So he invited me and we chatted in his office for an hour. And he said, you know, you seem pretty interested in this. You're pretty keen about it. Do you want to volunteer in the lab? And so that's what started my exercise physiology career, is, you know, born out of, you know, an interest in exercise performance.
That's so interesting. I love that. And I know eventually you ended up across town at San Diego State. So talk a little bit about why you went there next to pursue your education.
Yeah, one of my teammates, she actually was a distance runner. Her father is a professor at San Diego State in the Department of School of Exercise and Nutritional Sciences. And I just happened to meet him at a track meet. And so, you know, he was telling me like, oh yeah, no, like I'm not only just an exercise enthusiast, a sports enthusiast, I'm also a sports scientist, you know? And so he invited me to come see his lab and they were doing some really cool things. And so I had some challenges getting into graduate school because, you know, balancing the athletic, I didn't have the greatest GPA. I had an okay GRE, but I had a couple of publications from my time at UCSD. So, you know, I got into San Diego State on probation and, you know, just had to maintain a B average in the first semester. And it was just such an interesting vibe. It's such a different vibe than UCSD. But that's something I really enjoyed. And, you know, it was kind of cool to be in like a D1 environment and have a football team and all that. But I always stayed true, you know, you always stay true to your undergraduate. So I never really lost sight of who I was as a Triton.
That's awesome. We definitely love to hear that. When you were at San Diego State, what sorts of things were you doing in your classes and your labs?
So I was in the exercise physiology program. A lot of that stuff, actually, some of the expertise that we were doing in the lab was heat acclimation. So heat, if you exercise in the heat for an extended period of time, you know, as part of a training program, you do have adaptations. Your heart rate is lower, and then eventually your performance is better. It's analogous to like training at high altitude, for example, that your body adapts to become used to whatever your environment is. So we did a lot of stuff like that. You know, we sort of studied how our bodies thermoregulate. That's how it deals. How our bodies sweat. How quickly we sweat on the onset of exercise. But I actually did my thesis back at UCSD. So even though I was technically a San Diego State student, I had connected with another professor at UCSD, and I was able to do some exercise studies involving an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. So what we did was we looked at elite athletes. So in for these purposes, elite athletes were like high level nationals, international level cyclists, so aerobic athletes. And we wanted to see, you know, across a 45-minute bout of heavy exercise, does that do any damage to the lungs? Because there was a, you know, there's been reports that after a marathon or after a long race, people will be coughing up some blood or coughing up some pink sputum, and it's gross. But it sort of indicates that, you know, maybe these athletes, their hearts are so big and pumping so much blood, it actually causes some damage to the lung. So we wanted to see if we could actually image that, right? So we would put them on a bike, we would collect some blood during exercise, and we put them in the exercise. We'd exercise them, and then we put them in the MRI. And so we would have a pre and post look at how the lung changes before and after exercise. And so it was really cool. You know, got to do some high level physiology. It's real blood and guts physiology. So that was sort of my first foray into experimental, like the real experimental sciences.
That's so interesting. Was it challenging for you or interesting for you to go from being a scholar athlete to working with these athletes and performing these tests on them?
It was a natural progression for me. And I think that's somewhere along the way, like even though we studied elite athletes, I was never really interested in making elite athletes better, right? Elite athletes, like they're cool to watch and, you know, we sort of idolize them and, but you know, what good does that do other than, you know, if you get a great job as a trainer or exercise physiologist for a sports team. But the way I understood exercise physiology eventually is its clinical utility. And what I mean by that is if we're studying elite athletes who have supposedly the best hearts, the best lungs, you know, they've got more muscle fibers, they're arranged in a certain way. We have neurological brain adaptations, nerve adaptations. If you can understand the things that go right and make them so good at performing work, then we can understand what goes wrong in the clinical population, right? So when we put somebody with heart disease or lung disease on a bike, how and when they fail to continue exercising tells us a lot about their physical condition, especially if they're hard lungs. And so, you know, we use exercise as a stress model. Our heart rate goes up, our blood pressure goes up, our temperature goes up. And so as, you know, as we train, and that's sort of like the basic tenet of training, you push your body to a point where it fails, and then when you sleep, it fixes itself. But some of the things that fail happen chronically in heart or lung disease or other diseases. So that's sort of how I view, like, you know, people always wanted to say like, oh, are you going to be a coach? Like, no, I always wanted to do clinical science after I got into this field.
So then what was next for you after your time at San Diego State?
So I applied to several different schools and I wanted to go abroad. And this is a podcast, so you can't see me doing air quotes. I went up to the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada. So I went from, you know, the nicest weather on earth, 360 days of the year, to the coldest place on earth. Had snow 6 months of the year in Edmonton. And so it was, even though they speak English, it's still like a real cultural shock for me. I'd never visited other countries, but never lived in another country. So, you know, that was a fun way to sort of expand my international perspective.
Was the University of Alberta what you expected it to be then, or did it differ quite a bit from the U.S. university?
I think as a university, it's still quite, well, let's see. So it is a big university in the way that UCSD is a big university relative to other schools, and it's, you know, in regionally and across the country. And I would say, you know, the way that they approach their graduate education is a little bit different though. It's a little bit more one-on-one and they really focus on developing the researcher. Now, that's not to say that U.S. schools don't do this. They certainly do it very well. It's a little bit of a different attitude in how they teach their students. And also, you know, going to school in Canada is much, much, much cheaper because it's I mean, schools in the U.S. are state and federally subsidized as well. But, you know, going up there for a graduate school, you know, I had full tuition and I got paid to teach and to do research. And a lot of schools in the U.S. do that, too. But I was sort of surprised that none of my friends in my cohort had, like, you know, five figures of student loan debt. It must be an amazing thing, they said.
What were some of the highlights for you, whether academic or just living in Canada while you were there?
So to be honest, like, you know, as I said, it was a culture shock. And so growing up in the U.S., you know, we're sort of indoctrinated to think that America is the best. You know, we're the best at everything. We get the best schools. We have like the biggest military. Like we've got Wi-Fi. We're like, you know, they have Wi-Fi in Canada too. And so I think like, sort of, you know, and we'll talk about this later in my career in policy, but like, you know, the way that they approach healthcare, like universal healthcare, for example, it doesn't matter if you have a job or not. If you get sick, you will get medical care. And that sort of permeates through the Canadian culture and how they treat each other. And so, but, you know, specific highlights, I would say, outside of science, I'm a classically trained singer. I'm a vocalist as a baritone. And I got to sing the Canadian National Anthem for the University of Alberta and a couple of other professional games like the Oilers, which is NHL hockey team up there. And I also got to sing O Canada for the Edmonton Eskimos. So that's really fun and sort of nerve-wracking, right? Just like The thing about anthem singing is that everybody's paying attention. Like even in the U.S., like nobody is texting on their phone. Like everyone's standing up, paying attention, hand over your heart or whatever. And so if you do well, you know, people clap and then the game continues. Mm-hmm. But everybody hopes it, a little bit that you screw up. But they're like really hoping that you'd be on ESPN, like not top 10. They're forgetting the words. And the pressure of that is doubled as an American, right? Like I not only am I singing the Canadian national anthem to the demise of my Americanism, but I would never, ever hear the end of it. So, you know, really, I loved my time in Canada. I would love to go back. It's an amazing place to live.
Did you ever think that you would stick around once you finished the program?
You know, I had considered a lot of my options. You know, at the time, I was in a serious relationship with somebody I had met in graduate school. And so I kind of like waffled back and forth about what would have brought me the best opportunity. So, you know, I considered doing a postdoctoral fellowship up there, but ultimately I ended up back in San Diego. So the same professor who I did my master's with in 2011, 2009 to 11, got a grant and had some money for a postdoc. So I ended up coming back to UCSD sort of full circle in 2017 to do a 2-year postdoc with the School of Medicine.
That's so cool. It's like you can't stay away from UC San Diego. I love it. What's the appeal for you that brings you back to UC San Diego so often?
So I think that, you know, at the time I had a really great rapport with that particular professor. I still had a lot of friends here, especially had friends, you know, from the track team who stuck around, and it was comfortable and I was closer to my family again. You know, I didn't have to, you know, shell out hundreds of bucks to come home for Christmas. I could just drive up to Los Angeles, which was where my family was. And so it really felt like home, you know, and it was really familiar and, you know, could do some really great work. And, you know, because I sang, I got to come back and sing with my old choir, actually at UCSD, La Jolla Symphony Chorus. I'll just give a shout out there. And so it felt right, you know, and the challenges that was, you know, a long distance relationship and all that. It's, you know, in the end, like, you know, looking back and seeing the forks in the road and making these big decisions, at the time it's really nerve wracking, but it makes sense. It's easily to connect dots looking backwards.
So how did you end up then at the National Science Foundation where you currently work?
So I have always had an interest in science communication. Like we're taught to write papers and create posters and do PowerPoint presentations. And I realized I liked the talking about science, the educating, you know, and engaging with people more than doing the actual bench lab work. By bench lab, I mean like the actual blood and guts research. And so I found this opportunity. There was a booth at a conference that I was at from this organization called the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, for the Advancement of Science. And they had a program called the Science and Technology Policy Fellowships. And so this program that they had marketed it as sort of a recruiting tool for the US government, right? So they would take PhDs in STEM, so science, technology, engineering, and math, and they would place them in various places in the federal government in Washington, D.C. So you could work in the judicial branch, you can work in Congress, or you can work in the executive branch, which has many, many agencies. So I had sort of been thinking about leaving academia, because usually the path is like after a postdoc, if you're very lucky, 3 or 4 years of postdoc. If you're unlucky, like 8 years of postdoc, you find a professorship. And that wasn't my speed anymore. And I wanted to do something different. And so, like, you know, they flew me out to interview with 19 different federal agencies. And I just thought, like, wow, this is some of the smartest people on earth. They have PhDs, like they did postdocs or they were professors or whatever, and they decided to do something a little bit different. And it's funny, like sometimes I still talk to some of my colleagues in academia and they're like, so it's like an alternative career. And I'm like, well, you consider that like 85% of the people who get a PhD do not become professors. So what is really alternative careers becoming a professor? And I'm biased now because I love what I do now. I ended up at the National Science Foundation, as you mentioned, in the Office of Legislative and Public Affairs. So I, you know, just started my second year here. So it was a really great placement and feels right.
We're chatting with Vince Tejasaputra on this episode of TritonCast. So Vince, you mentioned that you do science communications. Talk about what exactly that is.
So science communication encompasses a very vast, it's a really vast landscape. So it can be as simple as, you know, writing out your results for a journal article, or it could be presenting your data to a community group. Like in my case, I was in a choir and I was studying, in my postdoc, I was studying healthy aging, and you know, lots of people in choirs are a little bit older, like at least, you know, like 60 to 80. And so I was already, I had like a really great meshing of, you know, my personal and my professional life. I studied lungs, singing, and so, and healthy aging, and that was all of them, right? So I got 30 minutes and I got to chat with my choir, and I said, like, here's the kind of research that we do. We're always looking for research participants. So if you're, you know, want to give some of your time, come into the lab, see what we do, maybe you can volunteer. And so, like, my ability to translate the science, not only our findings, but what we do and why we do it, and why the regular citizen or the lay person, as we call it, in the audience should care, because you pay taxes and, well, that funds our research, right? So there should be some value added. So generally, as a science communicator, I also help other scientists be better communicators. So not only am I a public speaker, but I'm a public speaking coach, right? So at the National Science Foundation, I'm on the public affairs side. And so a lot of the time what we do is we look for and we write up stories that help tell what we do at NSF, what happens to the funding, you know. So, you know, instead of, you know, if we have a scientist going to testify in Congress and the Congress wants to know where their money's gone, right? And if there's an appropriation, well, then we can say, you know, instead of saying, you know, last year we funded 2,000 graduate students, we can tell a story of a graduate student who, you know, emigrated here from Africa, and now she's studying how to make crops genetically modifiable to be drought resistant, right? So now, instead of just a number, it's a story that has an immediate human impact. And so my thing is using storytelling to really not just tell you what we're doing, but why you should care about it. And so that's like a little bit of empathy that I bring in. So we're always competing, right? Like if you go to a scientific talk or a lecture, it's always like this really boring PowerPoint slide. And immediately, instead of paying attention, which is the best case scenario of expert to expert communication, you're scrolling Instagram, right? And everyone's doing it. And even like, especially now we're Zoom to Zoom, right? And you just have this urge to check your email while somebody else is talking. So a lot of the distractions, like learning to cut through that noise is what I'm learning and trying to help other scientists be better communicators.
What do you think are some of the keys in order to communicate so effectively?
Well, first, it's knowing your audience. Number one is definitely knowing your audience. So if it's a group of another scientists, if it's a K-12 audience, if it's a congressional audience, like policymakers, or maybe you're trying to get, donors to donate money to your organization, understanding what they want and what they want to hear and customizing your message to that. Now, sometimes scientists will hear that, speak in front of a lay audience, and they sort of roll their eyes and they say, oh, we have to dumb down. And I think that really does a disservice with both scientists and the audience, because, you know, you're very smart. I'm very smart. I'm not necessarily an expert in whatever this person is talking about. I can figure it out. But instead of thinking of dumbing down the message, we're raising up, we're educating, we're raising the level of knowledge in the room. And so everyone in the room, instead of, you know, feeling lost or getting lost in emails or whatever, then they're now standing up and waiting to talk to you on a microphone. To me, that's a successful talk. Now, it might be that I presented some data that people said, oh, that's wrong. And that's fine, and we can have a great conversation about it. But generally, like understanding where people are coming from, that's the number one thing. And especially now, how do you get scientific information across in a way that's understandable and believable? And you see now, like, the credibility of scientists is sort of being politicized, right?
Absolutely. It's definitely an interesting time in this country. What has stood out to you from your time at the National Science Foundation the most?
So working in policy, so I back up a little bit. Of course, like after the 2016 election, everybody suddenly became a political pundit and just like reading political news all the time and seeing what crazy thing is happening in Washington next. Coming into policy, you know, and having a healthy dose of skepticism, saying like, oh, these bureaucrats, like, they're just lazy. But then I come here and work on real problems and realize that they're way more complicated than you think, right? And so if you're tuning in now and you're thinking about, you know, what happens in Washington, what happens in policy, what is going to happen in November in 2 weeks, just know that there's a lot of people who are really smart, really passionate about solving these problems. They're really true patriots. So if you don't believe me, come and do it yourself. Like, come to Washington when it's safe. Go visit your representative. You can walk right into, you know, the Rayburn House office and walk right out to AOC's office. You can do that. Most people don't know that. So, you know, it's sort of understanding that you as a citizen do play a really big role and a really important role. Of course, I'll take this time now to make sure that I don't know when this is going to come out, but if it's soon, I hope that you're registered to vote and get out and vote. Tell all your friends, tell your family, because it matters.
Absolutely. Always a good message. And it's got to be interesting for you living in the nation's capital. I mean, where so much of the politics happens and where the magic happens. How has your experience been like living so close to DC?
It's been a lot of fun. it's been a lot of fun back when the metro, riding in the metro was a thing, you know, living in a place that had really good public transportation was really fun. And having all these friends in different parts of federal government, you know, having a visit to the State Department, you know, or having lunch in the Senate cafeteria, like that's a really cool thing. Riding the Senate subway with Mitt Romney a couple of months, you know, it's just like, you see these like larger than life figures, that you see on TV in person and they're people, you know? And so a lot of the show is exactly that, like just, but when it comes down to it, people here are about business, just, you know, getting it done. Hopefully most of the people are interested in getting a compromise. But it's been really cool to be in the heart of it and sort of getting the insider knowledge and sort of the rumors and stuff. And it's just been so fun.
We're joined by Vince Tejasaputra on this episode of Tritoncast. Vince, I want to switch gears a little bit because you were talking earlier about singing the Canadian national anthem and being in a choir. When did you develop your passion for singing?
Quite a while ago, actually. So my mother passed away when I was 14, and actually 20 years ago now, as of Sunday. And she was a singer. She was singing choirs, and I always went with her, like in church choirs. When she passed away, I kept it going, you know, to sort of honor her memory. And so I got a... I sang in church choirs and school choirs, and I got a singing coach. You know, it's just sort of developed more as a hobby more than anything else. And then as I matured a little bit and my voice matured, I really found that I really enjoyed, you know, the stage bit, you know, and that really plays into my professional life as a public speaker. Really enjoy, not necessarily the attention, but like sort of the adrenaline rush of everybody's watching you. don't screw up the words, don't screw up the melody. And so that has really served me really well. And, you know, on that front, you know, singing in choirs and like meeting all of these amazing people that you sit next to for years and have no idea. You know, I sat next to somebody in La Jolla Symphony Chorus at UCSD for a couple of years and didn't know that he had founded, you know, International School of Policy at UCSD. He ended up writing me a letter of recommendation. You know, another friend of mine, former Navy pilot, now he's an environmental lawyer, another bassist, you know, we became friends and, you know, he wrote a great letter of recommendation. So, you know, I had never really thought about it as work and then play. It's always been intertwined. And so what I've done in my life is just followed things that have been fun with fun people. You know, whether it was like being an athlete and becoming an exercise physiologist or being a lung physiologist and becoming into singing or, you know, realizing that having the ability to stand in front of a group and speak confidently could bring me to policy. It's all tied together. So, you know, despite having like long work days, long work weeks, you know, it's always fun. Even when it's not, I'm always reminded that, you know, this is all labor of love. And so when I bring my authentic self to work, you know, I never have to compromise on my morals and my values because, you know, I'm bringing who I am to work and that sort of shows in my products, I hope.
Yeah. And it really does all tie together. I mean, when you're performing, are you thinking about like your lung capacity and communicating effectively and all these other things that you do?
I just really think hard and just pray that I don't screw up. It's funny because like, you know, my mind sort of goes blank and, you know, there's times where my body will just like really tense up and, you know, like having breathing exercises, you know, in my back pocket, right? I can try and calm myself down. I can bring my heart rate down and just really like solidify the sink or swim moment. And I don't know, it's funny because like, you know, we try and study breathing, but you never think about your breathing. Not really. Like maybe swimmers do, like, you know, in a pattern, but you never think, oh, time to breathe in, oh, time to breathe out. You know, it's something that's automatic. And that's like a really, really amazing thing. And I guess as another aside, we always argue with cardiologists and people in, you know, in heart sciences, like what's sexier, you know, lung science or heart science. And it's like, yeah, like heart disease is bad and heart attacks are scary, but like, have you ever not been able to breathe? You know, if you cover your mouth, you're immediately in a panic. If you can't breathe, you're immediately in a panic. And that's like now, like being in a global pandemic, like understanding lung science has also been, you know, really useful. It's funny, like a lot of my interviews for the AAAS fellowship were at the National Institutes of Health, and one of them was in the division of lung disease. They were looking for somebody with expertise in clinical physiology, and I realized I don't want to talk about lung disease anymore. I want to do something different. I want to do public speaking engagement. Came to NSF, COVID hit, and now I'm the resident lung expert. So yeah, it really does all tie together. It's just, yeah, it's great.
So how has the pandemic affected you then work-wise?
Like everybody, it has its challenges, and I am certainly a self-described extrovert. And I think that you sort of have to be a little bit to stand up in front of either a group of 10 or 10,000 or whatever. So a lot of the stuff that we had planned for 2020 through NSF. So for example, we had four panels at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. That got canceled, you know, and so that was really hard. So all of the public engagement, like we were going out to high schools and we were going out, you know, visiting universities and sort of like bringing science to the people. That all changed because now we're all at home. So now what I've been really interested in is mastering not just like surviving the art of communicating through a tiny screen, but really making it a good experience for both somebody who is speaking and somebody who is listening. And I was talking earlier about being distracted, like how do you break through those things? And so that has been a really fun challenge. And I think like everybody on earth now knows about Zoom. And so there is now a new market, right, for experts on how to give virtual talks, how and when to turn off your camera so you don't burn yourself out of your ninth Zoom meeting of the day. you know, these are all new challenges that, you know, actually like really come as an opportunity, because now I can give a talk and people all around the world can tune in. You know, before, if it wasn't recorded, nobody else could listen. So we're looking for opportunities to really take advantage of this now increased accessibility.
I love looking for the silver linings. I mean, it's obviously a very challenging time and we're not going to downplay that, but it's definitely good to see the positives like you have during this experience. Once the pandemic is over, what do you see yourself doing next for the National Science Foundation?
So my fellowship is only 2 years and I'm not really sure what's going to happen. So that would put me at September or I guess August 2021. I'm not sure yet. I'm sort of looking for jobs, poking around a little bit. I think I would like to stay in the public affairs space. If there's a change in administration, I would be interested in serving in the White House I don't know. And it's just like such a, you know, I like just stepped out of academia into this whole new world of possibility. But I do know that I love to continue public speaking, something around science, really working to build relationships with stakeholders. So it's either like, you know, congressional staffers or donors or lobbyists or whatever. You know, that's what I really enjoy, you know, listening to what people are needing and then sort of negotiating and finding a middle ground to get business done. So that's what I want to do next. I'm a little bit worried, but not really. Like, I think I'm in a good position, especially something as relatively high profile as a National Science Foundation, in that everybody on earth is talking science, right, because of COVID. And so, you know, we can really position ourselves to show like the kind of value that we bring to the American people. So, I mean, that's been a lot of fun, and that's the kind of stuff I do right now. But I am open to all possibilities.
Well, we're just about out of time for today. So last question for you, Vince. I know you mentioned singing, but what other things do you like to do when you're not busy with work?
lately, not much. you know, we're living in the DMV area, so that's a DC, Maryland, Virginia area. We're very close to the Shenandoah Mountains. And so I've been trying to get out and hike every weekend or so, getting outside, you know, stretching out the legs. So I try to stay doing the athletic stuff. Every day, actually, I do a personal training class for some of my classmates, my cohort mates. And so we log in at 5:15 on Zoom, and we do, you know, Monday through Friday, we do a different class. And so I'm able to use my PhD, to bring community to our little class. So that's really fun. And because I'm in public affairs, of course, I'm on social media all the time. So mm-hmm. I started a channel for, my quarantine kitchen. So it's been like, you're doing barbecue and like just stuff in the kitchen. It's just like fun little projects to keep me going in this time.
Very cool. Definitely love to hear all those interesting hobbies and things that people are picking up during this time. Well, we are out of time for today. Thank you so much for joining us today, Vince.
I really appreciate it. Last message here, wear a mask, wash your hands, stay home if you can, and please be safe.
Well, first of all, Jenny, I love that conversation because, as you know, I love O Canada. It's such a great national anthem. It's fantastic. And so to hear that Vince sings that and sung it well, like that just tugs at my heartstrings. But really, all the work that he's doing at the National Science Foundation is really fascinating stuff. Admittedly, some of that, a lot of it, is over my head, but man, that's just really, really cool and so amazing that he's been able to make that impact.
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely know about your love for O Canada, Jeff, but it's just so awesome how he's such a well-rounded person. I mean, his love for singing, his love for science and communicating in an effective way. And he likes to hike on the side. There's so much that he does, and it's so cool that he's so passionate about everything that he does.
For sure. And it's also really interesting to see just from a career path and how that's taken him really all over North America. It's fun stuff. Well, coming up on episode 19 of TritonCast, we'll meet former Triton volleyball player Chase Frischman, who went on to play professionally on the AVP Pro Beach Volleyball Tour. Come back and join us next week to hear Chase's story. New episodes of TritonCast premiere each Wednesday.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's show. For more on TritonCast, give us a follow on Twitter at TritonCast. And if you've got suggestions for future guests, or you just want to send Jeff and I a shout out, feel free to email us at traincast@ucsd.edu. See you back here next week.
You've been listening to TritonCast. TritonCast is a production of UC San Diego Athletics Communications. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast on your platform of choice. If you have show questions or comments or suggestions for future guests, email us at TritonCast@ucsd.edu. You can also follow the show on Twitter @TritonCast.